This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Joel Hilliker. The State of Israel has a new prime minister. Benjamin Netanyahu has been ousted. Naftali Bennett leads the new government. We'll hear from our Jerusalem correspondent, Brent Nachtigall, some of the implications of this new government, how it affects Israel's security and its relationship with the United States, and also how Netanyahu could actually return to power relatively quickly. We've seen some impressive missions to Mars in recent months and years, but what about Venus? NASA has just announced plans to learn more about our other closest planetary neighbor. We'll hear about this in a report from Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic. Then we will talk about face masks. We've all grown accustomed to them over the past year and a half as governments have imposed mandates to stop the spread of COVID. Increasing evidence now shows that not only do face masks offer poor protection, they also create serious health risks. We'll have a conversation with personal trainer and holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian about this. And I will conclude the program today with a word about something beautiful that happens in your life when you give a gift. Let's start with a look at the state of Israeli politics with the change of government in this report from Brent Nachtigall.
It took United States President Joe Biden 4 long weeks to call former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after he took office earlier this year. On Sunday, Biden barely waited 4 minutes to congratulate Netanyahu's successor, Naftali Bennett. Contrary to Israeli media hype in the lead-up to the swearing-in ceremony at the Knesset, Netanyahu didn't raise up an insurrection, nor did he start a war with Hamas in order to bust up Bennett's coalition before the vote. Instead, there was a peaceful and visible transition of power. After some fiery speeches in the Knesset, Netanyahu switched seats to become the leader of the opposition. And the Biden administration, and about half of Israel, couldn't be happier. Revelers at Tel Aviv's Rabin Square partied the night away with joy and tears. Sunday's changeover of power was an emotional achievement, the realization of a decades-long struggle to oust the chief villain of Israel's right. Singer Achinoam Nini symbolized the mood of the crowd when she took to the stage singing a version of We Will Rock You. Then she added, quote, "We got rid of Haman," quote, likening Netanyahu to the 5th century BC Persian official who set out to ethnically cleanse the Jews from the known world. Such is the hatred among some of those that wanted Netanyahu gone. The Biden administration's disdain for Netanyahu wasn't in any snarky comments against the former prime minister, but it was felt in the immediate embrace of the new government. It was a perfectly orchestrated play. Official statements of congratulations from Biden's team rolled in while the night was young. Biden said this in a statement, "On behalf of the American people, I congratulate Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, Alternate Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, and all the members of the new Israeli cabinet. I look forward to working with Prime Minister Bennett to strengthen all aspects of the close and enduring relationship between our two nations," end quote. He immediately followed up that with a personal phone call with Bennett. United States Secretary of State Anthony Blinken issued his own statement of congratulations for Bennett and immediately followed up with a call as well to Israel's new foreign minister and future Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid. Not to be outdone, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin also spoke to his Israeli counterpart, Defense Minister Benny Gantz, following the swearing-in ceremony. The message was clear. The Biden administration strongly endorses this Bibi-less Israeli government. It's what they've always wanted. And by always, I mean it's what Barack Obama fought hard to achieve during his time in office. Now, this is understandable. To the Biden administration, Netanyahu represented the major roadblock slowing Obama's vision of a radically reshaped Middle East. For 6 long years, Netanyahu countered the antagonistic Obama administration as it sought to downgrade ties with Israel and the Gulf states in favor with the radical Islamists of the Persian variety or that of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. This rebuke, started in private, but then burst into the open in order to counter the lies of the Iran nuclear deal. Filled with the very same Obama boys, this Biden administration is continuing to finish what Obama tried to achieve during his first two terms, getting rid of Netanyahu, the remaining international leader unafraid to publicly expose and thus blow the cover off the Biden administration's hostile, anti-Israel actions and Iran embrace, was a needed part of the strategy. On Sunday, we got a sense of what Israel missed from Netanyahu as he delivered his last speech as Prime Minister from the Knesset podium. The Prime Minister of Israel needs to be able to say no to the President of the United States on issues that threaten our existence, Netanyahu said. He went on to mention his 2015 speech before Congress, where he destroyed the merits of Obama's nuclear deal before the American people. Netanyahu then added, "Who will do that now? Prime Minister Yair Lapid? This government does not want and is not capable of opposing the United States." Then he said this, "The new administration requested that I save our disagreements on the Iran nuclear deal for behind closed doors and not share them publicly. I told them I won't act that way." Netanyahu then compared U.S. efforts to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal to the decision by then-U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt not to bomb the train tracks to Auschwitz in 1944. Quote, "We waited for salvation from others and it didn't come. Against the threat of annihilation, we had no savior. We didn't have a country then, and we didn't have an army. But today we have a voice, and we have a country, and we have a defending force," end quote. And yet, with all the military might that Israel has, it's hard to see a voice coming from this new government that would dare publicly expose the Biden administration. In his own remarks before the Knesset, Naftali Bennett stated that open rebuke for the United States will not be the policy of his government. Quote, "We greatly appreciate the support of the United States, our greatest friend. My government will make an effort to deepen and nurture relations with our friends in both parties, bipartisan. If there are disputes, we will manage them with fundamental trust and mutual respect," end quote. Bennett's remarks would perfectly be applicable to any normal United States administration, but not one that's fundamentally opposed to strengthening the state of Israel. This contrast of styles between the outgoing and incoming administration of how to deal with the United States is indicative of the broader change that has happened with Netanyahu's ouster. While Naftali Bennett is Prime Minister, he'll only hold that position for 2 years, after which it will go to Yair Lapid. In fact, Bennett is only Prime Minister because he was offered the job by Lapid in order to get him to join the coalition to oust Netanyahu. The offer was too good for Bennett to refuse, thus he broke his promise to his right-wing voters and joined the government. However, the real power behind this government is Yair Lapid. Mr. Lapid's Yesh Atid party received the second most amount of votes in the last election, and as such, he became the chief architect behind the formation of this coalition. As Yair Rosenberg explained in Tablet this last week, this is Yair Lapid's coalition. Everyone else is just living in it. The coalition was negotiated by Lapid and will have a majority of ministers from the center and left in deference to their greater numbers, and the government will rely on the vote of an Arab party for its continued existence. In other words, wrote Rosenberg, Lapid outfitted Bennett with a golden straitjacket, giving him the trappings of power without the ability to fully exercise it, end quote. Put another way, Israel now has a right-wing prime minister without any power to exercise conservative values. Bennett is entirely beholden to the doctrine of Yair Lapid if he wants to retain his job, and he can't blow up the government because given that he lied his way to the top, he'll likely not be voted into office again. And comparing Yair Lapid to the American political system, he's about as Democrat as you can find in the Israeli scene. And as such, this will be a government whose policies largely align with the base of the Democratic Party in the United States. Lapid's longtime campaign strategist is Mark Melman, who was used by John Kerry for his 2004 race, as well as for a host of other Democratic leaders, including former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. In 2019, Melman was replaced for a time by Joel Benison, Obama's own strategist, and he advised Lapid and Blue and White. After the breakup of Blue and White, Melman returned to advise Lapid. And as far as relating to the United States, Lapid has long disagreed with Netanyahu's face-off with Obama. In 2014, as a one-time member of Netanyahu's own government, Lapid set up his own secondary channels to talk to Obama officials, including John Kerry and Ambassador Shapiro. Eventually, the backdoor dealing of Lapid with the Obama administration contributed to Netanyahu's bust-up of the coalition with Lapid and the breakup of the government. No doubt, now in 2021, though, the Biden-Obama administration couldn't be happier that Lapid holds the reins of power in Israel. All the while, as the right-wing frontman, Naftali Bennett will provide the perfect justification to continue the Biden administration's anti-Israel position, as well as the hostile international media narrative against the Jewish state. Concurrently, Yair Lapid, with the support of the Israeli media, academia, and a rogue Israeli Supreme Court, will start to replace the traditionally biblically based values of the Jewish state with the democratic values of Israel's elite. In the short term, this is a horrific turn of events for Israel's future. Nevertheless, it is somewhat understandable why many Israelis are willing to give this Lapid-led government a shot. Even those that don't agree with Lapid's leftist values think it might be worth supporting his government to attempt to heal the rifts between the United States and Israel. Israelis long to return to an era of bipartisan support with the United States, even if that meant risking being led for a time by a leftist government. For the last 40 years, the United States has stood with Israel as its closest and most powerful ally. More than a relationship of convenience, the U.S.-Israel bond was a brotherhood of shared values and shared history. Even now, the familial bond that America and Israel has is likely still shared by most of their peoples. And for Israelis of all stripes, it breaks their hearts to see that relationship in tatters. Purposefully, the overwhelming media narrative in both countries blames Netanyahu and Trump for that division. With both gone, it's hoped the brotherhood can now return. However, as Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Jared Flory proves in his book, America Under Attack, the assault on the Israeli-American brotherhood did not begin with Netanyahu and Trump, but was spiritual in its origin. That hostility surfaced in the policy of President Barack Obama, who openly stated that it was his desire to fundamentally transform the United States. And as he did that, it was only a matter of time until he fundamentally transformed the relationship with the Jewish state. Given that Obama's men are in power once again, the hostility towards the Jewish state will continue, regardless of who leads Israel. Only now, the one man that was best aware of the nature of this fight has been removed from power. The United States will not go easy on Israel now that Lapid's government is in power. The question then will become, how far will Yair Lapid be willing to go in order to appease an increasingly hostile America? As Gerald Flory wrote last month, this relationship is likely to get so bad that Israel will need Donald Trump to return to power. Perhaps Netanyahu will return to power at the same time. The door is open for that eventually. Nevertheless, the Bible declares that this brotherhood between Israel and the United States will be broken in our time. As Trumpet Executive Editor Stephen Flory documents in his article Band of Brothers, the modern state of Israel, as well as the United States, are actually the modern descendants of the two of the ancient tribes of biblical Israel. Both nations were chosen by God to be the recipients of some of the most precious promises ever given to man. And because of this shared history with God, both nations are under increasing attack from the inside and out. In order to understand why the future of Israel and the United States are increasingly intertwined, it's important that you are aware of their shared biblical roots. If you haven't yet, please order your free copy of Herbert W. Armstrong's most popular book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, to prove their origins. In that book, you'll also see how one day soon, God will make the brotherhood between Israel and America stronger than it ever has been before.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We've seen some impressive missions to Mars in recent months and years, but what about Venus? NASA has just announced plans to learn more about our other closest planetary neighbor, as we'll now hear in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
The United States' National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, announced on June 2nd two new missions to the planet Venus. Each mission will receive roughly $500 million in funding, and NASA hopes to have both of them launched within a decade. The two projects amount to NASA's most significant missions to Venus in decades. One of the missions is the Deep Atmosphere Venus Investigation of Noble Gases, Chemistry, and Imaging, or Da Vinci Plus. Its main purposes are to analyze Venus's atmosphere and investigate if Venus ever had an ocean. It will also take the first ever high-resolution photographs of tesserae, a uniquely Venusian geological formation. Tesserae are compared to Earth's continents and may suggest that Venus has plate tectonics. Da Vinci Plus would be the first American-led mission to Venus's atmosphere since 1978. The other mission is Venus Emissivity Radio Science INSAR Topography and Spectroscopy, or VERITAS. It will orbit the planet and map it to create a 3D reconstruction of Venusian topography. This hopefully will confirm whether plate tectonics and volcanism are still active on the planet. It will also use infrared technology to determine Venus's rock types. Here's what Tom Zurbuchen, NASA's Associate Administrator for Science, said about the two developing projects. Quote, "We're revving up our planetary science program with intense exploration in a world that NASA hasn't visited in over 30 years. Using cutting-edge technologies that NASA has developed and refined over many years of missions and technology programs, we're ushering in a new decade of Venus to understand how an Earth-like planet can become a hothouse." Unquote. Venus was the first planet to be visited by spacecraft in 1962 by America's Mariner 2 program. Since then, while America has had subsequent missions to Venus, Washington has focused most of its outer space exploration to the Moon and to Mars. This is despite Venus being our closest planetary neighbor. Why is this? The Moon and Mars are both pretty hostile environments, but they're far more easily explored than Venus. Venus is the hottest planet in the solar system, with surface temperatures over 880 degrees Fahrenheit. Its thick atmosphere traps the sun's heat, causing scorching temperatures. Venus's atmosphere also contains clouds of corrosive sulfuric acid. Winds in its upper reaches can travel at roughly 224 miles per hour. The atmospheric pressure on Venus's surface is equivalent to the pressure 3,000 feet under the ocean. Because of this, most spacecraft sent into Venus do not last long. The Soviet Union's Venera 13 probe, famous as the first to send color images from Venus's surface back to Earth, only lasted for about 2 hours before being destroyed. However, this doesn't mean that Venus and Earth are all that different from each other. Many call Venus's Earth's twin. They're each other's closest neighbors. They have similar sizes, similar masses, and similar compositions. Yet while Earth is ideal for supporting life, Venus is a waste and desolate inferno. Was Venus always like this? Scientific evidence suggests otherwise. According to computer modeling from the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, in the deep past, Venus had a shallow ocean of liquid water, an atmosphere similar to Earth's, and moderate temperatures. It may even have been habitable, capable of supporting life. Some scientists even think that Venus's climate was even more stable than early Earth's. But if any of this were the case, then it all begs the question, what happened? Two planets sitting side by side with similar size, mass, and composition is rather remarkable. In a universe where most planets are barren, dead rocks, these two could have had just the right conditions to sustain life, which, it may be added, is much more intricate than many realize. Then, something happened. Today, Earth is still perfectly fine-tuned in every respect for life to survive and even thrive. Venus, meanwhile, is about as extreme and hostile an environment as it gets. Earth is a life-sustaining miracle, while Venus's surface is, to quote the opening chapter of the biblical book of Genesis, without form and void. Again, what happened? And why is Earth not in Venus's condition today? Late educator and theologian Herbert W. Armstrong asked similar questions in his book, The Incredible Human Potential. Did you ever wonder about the countless millions of shining stars you have seen on an otherwise black, cloudless night? He asked. Haven't you wondered about them? Are any of them inhabited? Did they evolve, as most scientists, astronomers, biologists, geologists theorize? Or were they created by an all-intelligent, all-powerful creator being? Were they created and set in space for a purpose? Do any of the planets contain any kind of life? Or are they all like our moon? Dead, decayed, lifeless, wasted, empty, uninhabitable. And if they are in a dead state of decay and lifeless, why would an intelligent creator have created them thus? Or did he? These are intriguing questions, and they have everything to do with the conditions of Venus and Earth and other planets. But where should one look to find the answers for such questions? Da Vinci Plus and Veritas have the potential to discover more about Venus than any other space program to date, but even their perspectives will be very limited. You don't actually have to fly to another planet to receive these answers. You can find them right here on Earth. A good place to start is requesting a free copy of The Incredible Human Potential, available at thetrumpet.com.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. Can you just tell us about the history of our exploration of Venus?
Well, as I mentioned, Venus is a much more hostile environment than some of the other nearby astronomical bodies like the Moon or Mars. So we've had a lot less success in exploring Venus and sending probes and whatnot over there simply because they just don't survive. As I mentioned, like the Soviet probe that they sent that took the first colored photographs of another planet, it lasted for about 2 hours before the probe was destroyed, and that was actually considered a success. They were expecting the probe to break down a lot earlier than that. But Venus was actually the first planet that mankind was able to send a spacecraft to. As mentioned, that would have been America's Mariner 2 mission in 1962, Mariner 5 and Mariner 10 in 1967. And 1974 did flybys. In 1978, which is the last time America sent a spacecraft to analyze Venus's atmosphere, that was when the Pioneer Venus Orbiter and Pioneer Venus Multiprobe was launched, and they studied Venus's atmosphere until about 1992. The final mission that America has sent to Venus, or final major mission rather, would be the Magellan satellite, which was in operation from 1989 to 1994. It has the distinction of being the first interplanetary mission sent from the space shuttle, which of course is not in use anymore. It orbited Venus and mapped Venus using radar. The Soviets actually have a much bigger involvement in studying Venus than America. Their Venera program is very successful. Their various Venera probes were the first, some of their probes were the first to beam data to Earth from another planet's atmosphere. That was Venera 4 in 1967. 1970, Venera 7, first successful soft landing on a planet other than Earth. Venera 13, the first audio recording from another planet. But ever since America's Magellan mission, there hasn't been too much. Europe and Japan have had a few programs since then, but nothing too major. And as I said, it's because mainly, even though Venus is so close to Earth, its atmosphere and its the challenges of bringing an object on the ground to study there are just so big that most missions, they do not manage to bring much before they end up breaking down.
So with the difficulties that scientists have faced and the limits of our understanding of this planet, what are the scientists' view on how Venus became so difficult and uninhabitable when they look at its origins and what made it the way it is today?
Well, there's actually quite a few theories floating around there, and not really one of them has majority scientific consensus. Some people think that increasing solar exposure due to Venus's closer proximity to the sun, as the sun got bigger, it dried up all of the hypothetical water that was on the planet, and which caused a massive injection of CO2, which caused a greenhouse effect on a major scale. That's not accepted by all scientists. Another theory is that large-scale increases of volcanic activity on various parts of the planet happened simultaneously and released CO2 in the atmosphere, causing another a similar effect as the first theory. But because Venus has been so hasn't really been studied by that many people at all, it's all speculation, basically, with a very limited amount of tangible, scientifically collected data to base their assumptions on. And so really, when it comes down to it, scientists aren't sure. And that's why they're sending programs like the Da Vinci Plus or the Veritas program in the hopes of figuring out more. But really, Venus is, in many respects, a mystery to the scientific community because of its inhospitability and just the difficulties of collecting information from there.
So in your report, you were talking about just the stark contrast between Earth being so perfectly fine-tuned for life, Venus being so dead, and really other planets that just don't fit the criteria for life, although that's what science just seems absolutely intent on trying to find on all of these other planets. But maybe you could just talk a bit about the fine-tuning necessary to support life.
Oh, of course. Well, we actually have on the website a booklet, The Awesome Universe, Our Awesome Universe Potential, which covers this topic in great detail. These are just a few snippets from that booklet. Like, for example, Earth has a perfect size and mass. If the Earth happened to be less dense than the atmosphere, it would be too problematic for the atmosphere to remain on the Earth. If it were more dense, then the atmosphere would be too thick. But with the size of the Earth, it's just the right size and density for an atmosphere to not just stick around, but also just be just the right thickness for life to exist. Earth's metal core has a magnetic field that protects our planet from space, from radiation, from radioactive elements, like say from the sun, and protects while radioactive heat from the core creates plate tectonics, which are necessary for life to survive. And Earth also has just the right mixture of certain elements in the body. 27 elements are specifically needed for the composition of humans, including carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, etc. And Earth has just the right mix of them. And not just the Earth itself, but the sun that we orbit. Most stars are found in groups of 2, 3, or 4, but because we have just a single star, it's able to create proper gravitational effects between Earth, and also makes less likely dangerous eruptions of tidal gas. Most stars are smaller than our sun. If our sun were smaller, then the Earth would have to be closer to have a the proper temperature for life to survive. But if it were closer, then that would mean there would cause tidal locking. In other words, basically the Earth wouldn't rotate, which would cause a lot of problems. But the interesting thing is, a lot of these, not perfectly, of course, but a lot of these features are that make Earth so fine-tuned for life are also found on Venus. For example, Venus has a magnetic core just like Earth. Venus, while it doesn't have all the elements that are required for humanity or for life, some of the elements that I mentioned, like carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, they're found on Venus, including in the form of water. Venus, as I mentioned earlier, is roughly the same size and shape as Earth. So while it's not perfect, there are correlations, there are similarities between the two planets, which makes the massive difference between how Earth is so perfectly fine-tuned to support life and for not life to just not even survive but thrive, whereas Venus is in so many ways just the exact opposite, so fine-tuned to make sure life never happens. it makes it all the more remarkable.
Well, it's fascinating. We'll keep our eyes on those projects. We've been talking with trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic about NASA's announcement of two future missions to explore Venus. He has written an article on this subject that you can read at thetrumpet.com. And you can also read our free booklet, Our Awesome Universe Potential, that puts these kinds of missions in a larger spiritual context. Thanks so much, Mihailo. Great to have you on.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
COVID-19 is a subject as politically charged as it is infectious. One example is the mandates imposed by many governments that healthy people wear face masks. Increasing evidence now shows that not only do face masks fail to protect us from COVID, they also create health risks. To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, personal trainer and holistic nutritionist, Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hello.
We've talked about face masks before. Some people apparently love these things. There are even people who are getting vaccinated. I actually saw that 46% of these people are still wearing the face mask even after getting vaccinated. But there are a whole lot of us who don't like them at all, and there are some people who actually have negative health effects from these masks. Can you just tell us about that?
Well, absolutely. And hopefully after today's program, there'll be a whole lot more people that won't like the masks. So up until now, a comprehensive investigation into these adverse effects has really been lacking. And that's why the media has jumped all over this. But that changed in April this year. There was a study in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, and it was groundbreaking. And it just showed all the symptoms of oxygen deprivation as a first step. So I'll just give you a background. The outside air contains about 20-21% oxygen and about 0.03% carbon dioxide. And so that's a healthy way to breathe. But with a close-fitting mask, with a mask right over your face, close to your nose, what we do is we change that ratio. So then we have a low oxygen environment and a high carbon dioxide environment. And then what you're doing is you're rebreathing that repeatedly and to your detriment. So it's really a faulty mixture which dilates blood vessels in the brain. And it causes so many of these short-term symptoms like dizziness and headaches, drowsiness, and there's increased heart rate and respiratory rates. I mean, many people complain about that. And these are the initial signs of long-term problems. So there was a medical research journalist. His name was Del Bigtree. He actually did a video which was fascinating. He measured the various masks like the face mask and the surgical mask and the N95, and he used a carbon dioxide sensor. And it was fascinating because the N95, it measured at 8,486 parts per million. So I'll get into the ratios in a second, but I'll just say that's incredibly high. Mm. And then it failed. So it went up to 8,400 something, and then it failed due to too high a reading. The surgical mask was at 8,934. And then a cloth mask, surprisingly, was at over 9,100. Huh. So each mask was fairly close. So you would think that the N95 would be worse, but it was a good deal worse, but the other ones are quite bad too. So there was a study by Harvard that actually backs this analysis up. And it shows that these high levels of carbon dioxide that you're rebreathing are extremely dangerous. So they said that breathing as little as 945 parts per million carbon dioxide appears to lower your cognitive ability by 15%.
Huh. Now, this might explain why all of the people who've been wearing these masks have come to love it so much. It's a cognitive decline.
That could be the link.
we have a theory here.
Now, you can put, if you go to 1,400 parts per million, and it pushes that percentage of cognitive decline up to 50%.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, remember, we were talking levels of 9,000 parts per million. So anything above 5,000 parts per million is considered extremely unsafe. And a lot of media pundits, they love to say that physicians wear these all the time and they're not dropping dead, you know. But the thing is, you know, they talk to physicians and they do studies and they show that 24% of them suffer impaired cognition. And that's in a room that has all the oxygen recirculated, you know, and they 71% get headaches. And they only use those masks one time. And once those go off the face, they just rip them off. They can't wait to get them off. Mm-hmm. So everybody suffers. Now, you know, what are the long-term side effects of low oxygen and high carbon dioxide? Well, your immunity drops. You have increased blood pressure. You have inflammation. You also have, which was surprising to me, metabolic syndrome, which is just a cluster of diseases like heart disease, strokes, and cancer, and even brain damage. Now, studies have shown that low oxygen levels to the brain is a major precursor to Alzheimer's disease. Hmm. We're not talking today. People aren't dropping in the streets by the thousands today. But studies show, you know, 10 years from now, we're going to have a lot of dementia and Alzheimer's. So oxygen deprivation damages every single organ in the body. That's one problem. The second is bacterial contamination, which really, this is, it's gross.
Yeah, so this is an entirely different thing. You've got that that mask right on your face. You're breathing out your, you know, whatever particulate that would be normally absorbed into the air is being contained in this little space right in front of your face. So lots of bacteria that is in close proximity to you for long periods that wouldn't be otherwise.
Well, that's correct. Now, fresh air, what it does is it strengthens our resistance to contagions, bugs, and common ailments. We know that. And that's a byproduct of what's called hydroxyl radicals. Now, that's in the fresh air. And these are molecules of oxygen and hydrogen that are lethal to pathogens. It's just fresh air, and it's very it's the great sanitizer.
Yeah.
Fresh air is good for you. And I do get a kick out of you know, when the media says, well, you get fresh air in a mask. You know, you can talk to a 7-year-old and say, if I put a mask on your face and then I take it off, which one do you think has fresh air? I mean, it's common sense. The air is literally rancid in there. So every time we breathe out, we actually expel bacteria along with other things, right? And what they do is they collect in the warm, moist environment that's in front of you. Now, everybody sweats in a mask. That's known. So they did a test of train commuters, and they took their masks, and it showed that over half of those contained over 100,000 bacterial colonies in their masks. And a small percentage, over a million. You have molds and yeasts and fungi.
Just the words bacterial colonies kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies, to be honest with you.
It makes your skin creep. Yeah. Because when you breathe out normally in air, that air is supposed to go away from you, and then it's safe, and then you rebreathe fresh oxygen again. But that doesn't happen in a mask. You're trapping the air, you're rebreathing, and you're increasing the pathogen load, and then that's delivered back into the lungs, and it becomes dramatically more dangerous with these viruses and bacteria and fungi. So then what happens then? Then you have doctors saying they're seeing facial rashes and fungal infections,
right?
bacterial pneumonias are coming up. And of course, Google says that's fake news. Doctors wouldn't know. Google does.
Yeah.
There's a physician doctor, Russell Blaylock. He's all over the news, and he's really against masks. And he says, you know, these bacteria also concentrate in the nasal passages, and then they go up through the olfactory nerves, and then they travel into the brain. Now, and that happens because we're wearing these masks time and again. We put them in our pocket. We hang them on the rearview mirror. You know, the public isn't used to wearing a mask. And if you wear more than 2 hours, you're in trouble with bacteria.
Wow. Now, maybe we could just talk a little bit about the mask materials themselves, what many of these masks are made of. Is there a problem with that in terms of its effects on our health?
Yeah, that was interesting. The deeper you search into this, the more you find out this stuff is not good. I mean, it's actually frightening what's in there. You have carcinogens, and they've tested these masks, and especially those blue surgical types, they're the worst. And I see so many people wearing them. So you have like carcinogens, and you have allergens, you have tiny synthetic microfibers, and the more you wear these masks, the more they come loose. And as well, which was surprising, you have nanoparticles that come loose, and you ingest those as well. And they found that both the textile and the non-woven surgical masks have all of this material. And so you're ingesting that, and again, you're harming your lungs, and you can also harm your brain from this. I mean, it goes through the entire body. What we're breathing through our mouth and nose is actually hazardous waste.
So would this would be even in the cloth masks, or the cloth masks is not so problematic?
It's not as problematic, but see, a cloth mask, you also get some fibers that you're breathing in. It was never meant to be in front of your face.
Yeah.
So people are taking material like t-shirt material and whatever else they would use for other means and putting it in front of their nose. And then whatever loosens in that material travels through your body. And we really don't have an idea yet, because this is so new of what happens. But there's so many warnings out there where doctors are saying, look, 10 years from now, we're going to fall on our rear ends finding out what's really happening here.
Well, yeah, I guess that this is kind of an interesting upshot of all of this. And you mentioned it regarding the long-term symptoms of cognitive decline and impacts on dementia and other things. We're focusing so much on dealing with this immediate threat. This has been kind of a theme through the entire response to coronavirus, is we've been ignoring some of the ripple effects of these policies that we've put in place to address the short-term problem. And the long-term effects could be with us for quite a long time to come.
Oh, you hit that one right on the head. COVID-19 is fatal for approximately 1% or less of people who contract it. So it's nothing to sneeze at. It has killed a lot of people, but I think the statistics are very padded. And then it's mainly for the elderly and sick. So COVID kills those who are weaker in society, according to the CDC and NIH. Now, on the other hand, the side effect of the mask, I think, is far more significant, and it's not reported properly because it's with both healthy and sick people. And what I've talked about today is called mask-induced exhaustion syndrome. All having all of these factors together, this lack of oxygen, too much carbon dioxide, this bacteria, as well as the stuff that's in the mask, the carcinogens and such that are harmful to us. And that just leads to a perfect storm, as we've heard about with COVID, you know. I think this perfect storm is far worse than COVID, and we'll find out about this. One thing I'm noticing in the media that, you go to sources and you try to find something, and Google just says, this no longer exists, no longer exists. This has been proven fake. And it's really sickening because it's not fake news. There's actually very intelligent neurosurgeons and doctors, thousands of them, and they're warning us. And they're saying, you know, we could have a far worse problem with this mask on our face, trying to prevent something that has a smaller percentage of deaths than we could be experiencing down the road with all this disease that's going to happen.
Now, there are a lot of people who are enjoying somewhat reduced restrictions that force them to wear the masks. And if you don't have to wear a mask, don't wear it, is basically what you're saying. If you do have to wear a mask, do you have anything that might help the person who maybe must wear a mask because it's required by their place of work or whatever?
If you have to wear a mask, you must wash it frequently. Never wear a mask more than once. And I'm forced to wear a mask at the moment at my work, where I work in a gym, and I wear the plastic type over my face. So it sits on your nose and your chin, and I actually have a gap, and I haven't had a problem with it. No stores have stopped me, and I'm able to actually breathe quite freely. But even so, and I've noticed that, I have a scratchy throat, at times. And I noticed that there's still bacteria going on. And you have to clean every surface that's that close to your mouth. And make sure you get a lot of fresh air. Yeah. Like I said, it's the great sanitizer. Get that mask off as soon as you can. You know, boost your immunity God's way, naturally, by breathing in fresh air. You know, add some exercise, sunlight, and eat good, and then you don't have to worry about the crazy backwards ideas of men. I mean, in essence, don't wear this mask longer than you have to. If you're by yourself walking outside or you're in your car, there's no risk at all from anyone.
Yeah. Well, we sure appreciate it. We've been talking with personal trainer and holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian about the health risks associated with face masks. He's working on an article that should appear soon at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Jorg. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
I remember some years ago, there was a time my daughters each received a small toy. And within a few short hours, the youngest of them had lost hers. And when she realized it, she started to cry. And her sister said something to her that left me pleasantly shocked. She said, "That's okay, you can have mine." That kind of spontaneous generosity, that's not habitual in my children. But I watched as she handed over the toy, and she was genuinely happy to give it, even more than her sister was to receive it. Why do we give gifts? Why give to our children, our spouse, or other family members, or friends, or someone in need? Generally, it's not to try to get something in return. We just give for the pleasure of giving. It is more blessed to give than to receive, it says in Acts 20. Living the way of give makes us happy. But giving also does something else to us, something more specific, and that's because of a remarkable dynamic set in motion when we obey God's law. Jesus Christ instructed us to lay up treasures not on earth, but in heaven. And he explained the profound reason, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. You can find that in Matthew 6:21. Now, that's an extraordinary truth. Our heart tends to follow our treasure. Wherever we give some physical thing, not just our money, but even our time or energy, we tend also to commit something even more precious at the same time, a little piece of ourselves. We see this rule in action with tithes and offerings, which are commanded in the Bible. Give 10% of your income to God. Give free will offerings at appointed times in the year. Well, God doesn't need our money. He could provide for his work in any number of ways, but he instructs us to commit our treasure to that work. Not only does that instill in us the habit of generosity that develops our character and makes us more like him, who's the great giver, it also draws our hearts into his work. We take on a more committed mindset toward God's plans, his ambitions, his activities today, and how they're preparing for the future. If you think about it, that act of giving helps us love God more. That's what God desires most of all. In ancient Israel, God wanted to lay claim to the hearts of his people. In the same way, he commanded that the Israelites offer regular sacrifices. There were daily and weekly and monthly and annual offerings. And obviously, God didn't have any practical use for the animals and the other food and drink that were offered to him. His goal in having the Israelites give was to change their thinking, to turn their hearts toward himself. There's a clue to this truth even in the word sacrifice. In Hebrew, one word for sacrifice is korban. The root of that word is the Hebrew karab, which means to approach or bring near or close. That's just a really lovely word referring to a sacrifice for God. The similar word karab actually refers to a personal relationship or kinship. When an Israelite brought an offering to God, it was intended to bring him closer to God. Surely God was pleased with the act, but that wasn't the primary reason he commanded it. Presenting that gift to God was meant to make the giver feel closer to his creator, more than the other way around. He was committing his treasure to God, and so his heart followed. Notice how this law plays out in your life. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. If you invest your money, your time, your energy into your family, your heart will follow. If you give to and you sacrifice for your marriage, even if you don't feel like it, you'll find that physical act actually leading your heart into a deeper love. Your obedience to the way of give, even in just that physical sense, will set in motion the wheels of love. By the same principle, if you're constantly making sacrifices for your employer, that doesn't make him feel closer to you nearly as much as it makes you feel closer to him. Your heart follows your treasure. Over time, you may then find yourself making greater and still greater sacrifices for your work. And that might not be a good thing in every case. Just consider this practical wisdom. If you want to make your love towards someone grow a little, give that person a gift. If you want to make your love grow a lot, then sacrifice for him or her. Maybe there's someone that you're thrust into regular contact with that you have a hard time relating to. Maybe one of your coworkers really gets under your skin. Well, try it out. Give him something. Make a sacrifice for him, not to turn his heart to you, but yours to him. Give and see if it doesn't draw you nearer to him. It might not solve the problem completely, but you can be sure it'll improve your attitude. If you had an argument with your spouse in the morning and you're feeling resentful, do the counterintuitive thing. Pick up a bouquet of flowers on your way home from work. The next time you see her, rather than giving her the lecture you've been rehearsing all day, give her a gift she may actually appreciate. Whether or not she does, you'll find that your sacrifice has done a lot to dissolve your own hostility. Now you're in a far better position to restore harmony to your marriage than you otherwise would have been. Commit your treasure and your heart will follow. Don't wait until you feel love, quote unquote, before you give or sacrifice. Give and sacrifice and love will grow. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal, Mihailo Zekic, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Daniel Greenfield. No constitution can protect a people that does not know or care about what it says. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.